We're going to look at Genesis chapter 6 today, one of the most famous passages, as far as I'm concerned, ever preached during Advent. Yeah, right. Stand with me, please, in reverence to the Word of God as we look at this passage. Genesis chapter 6, verses 5 through 8. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man, whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heaven, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And may his blessings be added to that reading this morning, and you may be seated. Once again, is that not that the most famous Christmas passage you've ever heard preached? Continually, isn't it? You're going to see why, I believe, Tripp, and studying all of this, I believe this is a wonderful place for us to begin our Advent series of messages. Now, I want you to listen carefully. I'm just going to make a couple of statements here. These are what they call propositional truths. And I'm going to ask you to raise your hand this morning. Not in a form of praise like we should every once in a while here, but as in a response to this. Okay, now here's the propositional truths. Tumnus is a fawn. Beavers can speak. The wardrobe is in the spare room. In Narnia, it's always winter, but never Christmas. Aslan isn't safe, but he is good. How many of you have absolutely no idea what I just talked about? Okay, so the rest of you absolutely know everything that I was talking about. Is that what you're saying? Did you notice that half the people raised their hands like, what's he talking about? Anybody under the age of 15 want to tell me what that's from? Go ahead. It is from Narnia. It is from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, written by C.S. Lewis. They are propositional truths. This is all true from the book that he wrote, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Everything there. Beavers can speak. There's a wardrobe that is in a spare room. Aslan, not safe, but he is good. And it's always winter in Narnia. But it's never Christmas. Those are truths that you would find within that. But you have no idea what I'm talking about. If I just got up here and just began to babble those type of propositional truths to you all day here, you would all soon have me in a padded room and escorted away. You would, gibberish, man. It's gibberish. Shut up. That's what it would be. The Christmas story can be the same way if we don't understand in context what the Christmas story is all about. If you jump into the middle of any story, if you jump into the middle of Narnia, if you just look at these propositions and say, what is he talking about? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense because we don't understand the entire story. We don't understand from the beginning the Pevensey kids as they leave England after the bombings and they go to their uncle's place in the country and they find an abandoned wardrobe which is magical. And as they enter into that particular wardrobe, they find the land of Narnia, which is inhabited by speaking animals and half humans, basically run by a bad witch. She's a white witch. But yet overall is the good Aslan, who is a lion. And the story unfolds as they finally come to the conclusion that one of the Pevensey kids has betrayed the rest of them. There's been a betrayal. And the laws of the land and the laws of eternity require the death of that child. And yet, there is a loophole within that, that there could be the death of an innocent in his place. And Aslan takes his place, not realizing the magic. After Aslan is killed, Aslan raises himself back to life. And so you once again see the picture. C.S. Lewis would actually begin to give us a metaphor of the very scriptures that we talk about. But within that is an amazing imagination. And all of those truths that I read to you are absolutely true in Narnia. But they're not to you and I if we don't know the story. The same way it is if the Christmas story. We don't understand the baby in Bethlehem. We don't understand the baby in the manger and all that it ramifications if we don't start at the beginning of the story. If you just begin with Advent, just the baby being born, and you're coming into the middle of the story. And so therefore, you won't understand why the jubilant singing and the celebratory songs of the angels. What was that all about? Why would they be celebrating? Why would we be concerned about the anticipation, the fearful anticipation of the wise men as they would travel? What about the political ramifications to a guy by the name of Herod? What about the shepherds in total shock and awe and fear as they run? What does that all come from? I mean, we know it's part of the Christmas story, but if we don't understand the very beginning, it doesn't seem to make any sense to us. I want to say one thing this morning about this message and the whole series of messages, that the story of that little baby that is born in Bethlehem thousands of years ago, the story is rooted, it is absolutely rooted in the grief in the heart of God. I want you to catch that. The story, the middle of the story, the baby being born, is rooted in the grief in the heart of God. That's what our story is all about. We aren't going to understand the glory of the manger. We aren't going to understand Mary holding this baby. We're not going to understand Simeon when he comes to see the consolation of Israel. If we don't understand that deep down, the whole glory of this story is rooted in the grief in the heart of God. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intentions of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. That's where the story begins. That's where the Advent story begins. And we have to understand that this is a deeply personal story. A deeply personal story. We have to understand the nature of this. The Lord was sorry. The Lord was grieved about something. This whole idea is that there is a personal connotation here. There is a personal offense going on. There is some kind of personal betrayal, if you will, that has occurred. What personal betrayal, what type of an offense could be so significant that it brings tears to the heart of God? What is it? Think about that. Literally, to bring tears to the heart of God. What is it that could be so offensive that it has done that? Look at verse 5. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intentions of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Can you get any more explicit than that? This is all inclusive. This is at the very core of what this is about. The inhabited earth at that particular time is inhabited by a people which is connoted by and seen by being continually evil in the sight of God. That every intentions of their heart is evil continually. There's not a break in it. There isn't righteousness being done by anybody at this particular time. But that man is connoted at this particular time by being evil continually. The very heart of him is his intentions are to do evil against him. There's no sadder passage in all of scriptures. We really don't understand the horror of it. We don't really grasp the tragedy of this whole thing unless we begin to understand this relationally. It's easy for us to back up and say there's no personal relationship. It's just kind of a story. There really is no story when you read the story of Narnia. There's no personal connection that you're going to have in that particular story, and it's only good for that particular purpose. But this horror and the tragedy of the scriptures only begin to take life to us when we understand that there is something relational going on here. that this is a close, intimate relationship which has been betrayed. This is deeply personal. And if we don't understand that, when we go to the baby in the manger and we want to grasp the glory of that baby, we're only going to get a portion of it until we understand the deep relational meaning of this baby actually coming. Humans were created and they're hardwired for a particular purpose. This week drove me crazy as I began to look through the scriptures. I mean, it was a principle that within this outline that absolutely made sense, but it drove me crazy to be able to do some research to find what would that point really mean. And I knew it to be true. What does it mean that humans were created, that we are hardwired to do something in particular, and that particular thing is to love God? I want you to think about this. People, ever since the Garden of Eden, have been hardwired for a purpose. Now, many of you are carpenters and bricklayers and accountants and, I mean, go through all litany of things that we actually do. We can talk about being mothers and we can talk about being fathers. And we're not all hardwired for those particular matters. We're hardwired to that end. Some of us are more emotional than others. We're not hardwired the same as others. But there is an element of continuity between all of us, and that is that each of us, since the Garden of Eden, have been hardwired for a particular purpose, and that is to love God. If I tell you what the Shema was, would we understand what it is? We would understand. I actually had several beautiful renditions of it being sung. But the Shema is what they teach to the youngest and the earliest of Jewish kids to understand that their whole perspective of, quote, religion is bound up in what they call the Shema. And it's found in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 4 through 5. Listen to this. This is what they teach their kids. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. You're going to see that Jesus later on is going to summarize the entire law, recapitulated in that particular verse alone. You want to know what the entire purpose of mankind is? You want to know what the entire law of God is? Is to love your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your might. It is what we have been hardwired to and for. There is a God consciousness about each of us. Several weeks ago we looked at that. That there is a void within mankind that is shaped, and C.S. Lewis didn't actually say this, but he gave a lot of indications that this is what he believed. There's a God-shaped void within us that can only be filled by God himself. There is a God consciousness about it. That means that everything that we do, every thought that we have, every motive that we have, every action, every choice, every word, everything that we do is formulated by the picture of God himself. If somebody should ask you, why are you doing what you are doing? If you would be honest biblically with that particular person who asked you, why are you doing that? Why are you doing whatever you're doing right now? You can easily say to them, because of God. That is how I am hardwired. That is how you are hardwired. That is how the person that you would be talking to is hardwired. That everything that I am supposed to be doing and should be doing is about God himself. I recognize God's existence. I recognize his authority in my life. I recognize his grandeur. I recognize that this is a personal love and that all of my time and all of my energy needs to go into expressing my love for God. It is what we have been hardwired to. We were made to love God in every aspect. This is the deeply relational perspective of these passages. And for us to really grasp the baby in the manger, we need to grasp this. And so I began to look closer what this love of God actually was. I don't think there's anything more challenging in Scripture than to be able to explain exactly what this love for God is all about. Jesus is going to recap it in Mark. when the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the teachers are going to say, yeah, well, hey, teacher, you've been pretty smart so far. What's the greatest commandment of all? And he's going to capitulate to the Shema. He's going to recap the Shema with them. He's going to say this very thing to them, that the most important commandment is what we were talking about, to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your might. But it's interesting, as we began to look at the covenant that God made clear back in the Old Testament, this particular covenant, loving God, assures us of God's sustained favor. Okay, now I'm going to be careful when I say this, but loving God, doing what God has required, assures us of sustained favor with God. It doesn't mean we gain our salvation. It doesn't mean that I keep my right relationship with God that is judicially sealed for all of eternity. It doesn't mean that I gain any more favor with God. But to assure continual favor from God really points to the fact that we need to be obedient. We need to be in love with God at every point of our lives. Listen to what Moses says, that Yahweh, the Jehovah God himself, keeps covenant and steadfast love with certain people, with those who love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations. That God keeps his covenant with those who love him, but he repays to their face those who hate him by destroying them. Think about Paul's declaring in Romans 8:28, all things work together for good. Have you ever just claimed that to somebody? All things work together for good. You better continue it. All things work together for good to those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. And so that if we step back and we say, look, this is for your good, and we know that there is blatant disregard for God's law and for obedience, we can't claim Romans 8:28 for that. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God. That is why many people have tagged, if you will, the Shema, the all command. Because there's threefold alls in there. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your might. There is no room for any type of divided affections here. Oh, I love God on Sundays. On the rest of the week, he's okay. But I really fall in love with him Saturday nights and into Sunday, and so I have a divided affection. Or my efforts, that which I'm going to put into it. I put all my efforts into that Sunday. The rest of the week, okay, God gets his place at times when I'm called upon, but that which I do, my efforts and my might, and whatever, it has its place, but there's somewhat of a division. Jesus himself said you cannot serve two masters. You'll love one, you'll hate the other. So if there is, in fact, a God who stands absolutely supreme, absolutely powerful, then he demands our supreme loyalty to that. Now, what does it mean to love the Lord your God with all your heart? It's surprising as I began to look at this week and realized that the Old Covenant, the Old Testament covenant, and it's the do's and the don'ts, right? Okay, I mean, if you think about an Old Testament covenant, you think about what did God give Moses to bring down to his people? He gives them 10 suggestions, right? He gives them 10 commandments. Here's the do's. This is what you'll do. That's pretty much how the Old Testament seems to come across, that here's a list of do's and don'ts that you have to do to maintain your favor with God. But it's really not, because it's all wrapped up to a matter of within. Yes, you outwardly keep these commandments, but it ultimately comes back to a particular point of being within. What does your heart, what does your soul, what does your very being find its satisfaction in? From the heart flow the springs of life, according to Proverbs from the Old Testament. A person's will, his desires, his affections, all rightly have to align for a life of love to be possible. Listen to Moses calls him to Israel in Deuteronomy 5. Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, the Lord your God disciplines you. Know in your heart. You see how Moses right off the bat begins. It isn't simply a matter of these do's and don'ts outwardly collecting and keeping these particular rules, but know in your heart that God is going to discipline. Listen to, talks about, once again, Moses talking about Yahweh himself. Know therefore today and lay it to your heart that the Lord is God in heaven, above and on the earth between. There is no other. Lay it on your heart. Lay it inside of you. Don't simply keep this rules and regulations on the outside, but know deep within your heart, this is an inward matter about whether you truly love God, whether you truly obey His commandments. You can keep it on the external, but if it doesn't come from within, from in your heart, then it has serves absolutely no purpose, nor can you claim the promises of God to maintain in favor with Him. Deuteronomy 6, verse 6 anticipates, once again, and I'm going to want to read all of these because there's so many of them here that I could be going over, but all of these matters within the heart, all of Deuteronomy 6, 6, all of these matters anticipates an amazing promise of Jeremiah. Still in the Old Testament, all about within the heart, all about matter of saying this has to begin within the wellsprings of who we actually are deep down. It anticipates an amazing working that God is going to promise in Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 33. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. All the time, Moses has been telling them, this is all a matter of being in the heart. This is all a matter from within. Lay this upon your heart. And then the promise comes through Jeremiah that God, someday, I will put my law within them, and I will write on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And so you see the picture of what Jesus is going to do when he holds that cup up in that Last Supper and said, this is my blood of a new covenant. The new covenant was what Jeremiah was talking about. Is it simply a matter of keeping all these outside, keeping the Ten Commandments? No, it's a matter of being heartward toward God, saying that from within I love God, from within I obey Him, not simply outwardly. So when it begins this, love your God with all your heart, it means that it's something that occurs within us. And then love the Lord your God with all your soul. What does he mean by that? I found this extremely interesting. The first five books of the Old Testament, the soul refers to one whole being as a living person, which includes one's heart, but it is so much more than simply the heart, simply the inward person. It is who they actually are. Think about Yahweh, God formed the man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living soul. It wasn't simply, he's taken it to another level. He's saying, okay, it is a matter of being from within, but now I want to show you that you will live with your hands. You will live with your eyes. You will obey God, and you will love God with your body. You will love God with that which you are. Love the Lord your God with all your might. Takes it even to a further level. I found this fascinating. The word might, or strength, is the same word in the Old Testament, appears 298 times in the Old Testament. 300 times this word might or strength appears. But you shall love the Lord your God with all your might. Same word, 298 times. Most of the time, it's an adverb, and it simply means very. Very. 298 times it appears as the word very. It only appears here in Deuteronomy and one other place in 2 Kings where it's the exact same thing being said when it says, turn to Yahweh with all your heart and with all your soul and with all his might. The only place that we find it recorded, the word might, is here. Everywhere else, that same word is called very. Just it's an adverb, very. And you can begin to think about that. I'm supposed to love him with all of my very. All my veriness. Okay? I need to love the Lord my God with all my veriness. And we begin to take a close look. We look further at the translations, the Greek translations that are going to be later given to us, or the Aramaic, which ultimately ends up being replacing the Hebrew, which is one of the Jewish languages. Their translations in the Aramaic and the Greek change these words to power and to wealth. So you shall love the Lord your God with all your veriness. You will love the Lord your God with all of your resources. Everything that you have, it comes from within. It includes your body and the fact that it's the soul. But then it becomes your very veryness. You shall love the Lord your God with an amazing step. You will honor him with your wife, with your spouse, with your kids. You will honor him and you will love him with your work, with your leisure. Every bit of resource that you have, you will love the Lord your God with. That's what he means by this. This is the Shema. This is what you will love the Lord your God. It becomes from a matter of within. It's not simply keeping that list, but it is a matter of a heart change, a heart attitude, an inclination of the heart. It then includes your body. It includes your soul. It includes what God has made you to be. That your desires, your passions, everything about you, you will love the Lord your God with. And then all of your veriness, all of your resources, anything God has entrusted to you, your time, all of it, you shall love the Lord your God. Also, I want us to understand that it isn't simply something spiritual. It isn't simply something that God says, I'm just simply going to do. I am requiring every human being to do this. Whether they have been awakened to the truth or whether they have not been awakened to the truth. Whether God has taken their heart of stone and given them the heart of flesh or whether he has not. It is a requirement for all mankind to love the Lord their God. It is how we are wired. All of humanity is wired to love. Everything we do, every instant of our lives, everything that you have done this week, you have been driven by or motivated by love. You're a bunch of lovers. Okay? That's what you are. I'm a lover, not a fighter. I used to hear that back in the 70s when I grew up. I mean, just for cowards who didn't want to stand up most of the time. But we think about it. We are all lovers to some degree. Everything that motivates, every action that we have taken has been motivated by love. It was intended to be motivated by God love. But it turned into something completely different. It's not a list of rules. It's not a bunch of do's and don'ts. Obedience is not simply being technically submissive to a bunch of rules. Yep, I did that. Yep, I haven't done that. Yep, I did that this week. Yep. I can get right down the list. Technically, that is not obedience. It is a matter of saying that rooted in the fact that every bit of me, every cell of my body loves God, and that's what motivates me. Why do I want to be obedient to God? Because God, who I love with every bit of my soul, is a lawgiver. He is a lawgiver, and I love him. Everything that I do is to please him, to bring him honor, to bring him glory. And he has given laws. And because he has given laws, I then submit to those laws. I become obedient to the law of God because, not because I fear him, but because I love him. Every aspect of who I am, every cell in my body cries out because I love him. I mean, think about your own personal relationships here on this earth. Think of the horizontal relationship. If you love somebody, don't you want to serve them? If you truly love somebody, don't you want to serve them, to see their joy, to participate in their joy? That's how we truly know when we love somebody. I want to participate in your joy. I want to serve you. I want to see the smile upon your face. I want to see the assurance that I have done well with you because I love you. That's how we know if we love on a horizontal level. It is what it means to actually to live. That's the plan of life. For us to obey out of an obedient heart toward God because ultimately I love him with everything that I am. And then clear, becomes very clear here on our passage this morning, Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. Something's happened. Something's happened. Okay? If that was the intentions of mankind and God is looking down upon it, he has realized that what I had intended to happen, what I had intended for these people to do, to love me with everything about them, has gotten turned cattywampus. Everything has been turned upside down. They're loving something, but they're not loving me. They no longer find joy in me. They no longer find joy in being obedient to me and to my laws that I have given them. That was evidence of true love for me, angels. That's what would be evident. And look, they're not keeping it. And there is no boundaries with these people. Their love has been turned aside to something else. If love for God is the ultimate command, then the ultimate evil is failure to love God. If loving God is the ultimate command that God has given to hardwires, then the ultimate evil, the ultimate sin, is not loving God. When I don't love God, when I will not stay within His boundaries that He has set down, I will not live for His glory alone. There is something else that has replaced that. It's interesting that we as humans, when it says that we don't love God, I want you to keep this in mind. When you say you don't love God, doesn't mean you don't love. You just don't love God because you are hardwired to love. You will always love something. What the Scriptures tells me. And so therefore, there isn't a point you're saying, well, I really didn't love God at that particular point and it wasn't a matter of love anyways. Yes, it was. I'm hardwired to love something. You will give somebody, something, the love that is due only God. Nobody in this room is loveless. God demands, God owns at the most profound level of your life. He demands it, He claims it, the love of your heart. It is what He made us for. Evil and wickedness grieves the heart of God. So what love is it? What love was so seductive at that particular time to draw away a people, all people, away from loving God, which is what they were created for? What was the love? Paul tells us pretty clearly in 2 Corinthians, and you'll see it played out here, but he writes it, a brief comment about why this baby Jesus is going to be here. And why did Jesus actually come and be born in that stable anyways? I think Paul gives us a pretty clear indication of this, about the love in our heart. Listen to 2 Corinthians 5:15. And Jesus died for all, and in essence, Jesus came to be born in Bethlehem in that particular manger, that those who live might no longer live for themselves. The heart of man being continually evil was the fact that they lived for themselves. They loved themselves more than they loved God. They found upon the very throne of their heart something climbing up that throne slowly where God and God alone was to sit. And what do we have seated on the hearts of the mankind at that particular point? Themselves. They're the ones that climbed that throne. They're the ones that took that seat. Jesus came to be born in Bethlehem so that we may no longer live for ourselves. That's why He came. It doesn't take a whole lot to look around, does it, to see just how selfish we are and how self-love enters into absolutely everything. Ask the question of married people in here today. I ask, how many of your marriages are easy? Don't raise your hand. Do not raise your hand. In fact, don't move. Okay, just don't even move right now because your spouse will sense that. Okay, so I'm giving everybody permission not to respond to this question. But how many of us have found that marriage is actually easy? It's not easy. It's hard work to make marriages thrive. Why? Because the love that I'm supposed to have for God and extend that to my spouse has been replaced for a love of myself. Why do you argue? Because you want to win the argument. That's reason. It's self-love. It boils down to that. Why is it hard to serve one another? Why is it hard to serve other people? Because I want served. What sits on my throne is me, not God. And God has said for me to serve others. His boundaries that He's put down. I have put myself there, and so I want served. Why is it hard to raise kids? Because we give birth to little self-sovereigns. Okay? That's what we're giving birth to. Little self-sovereigns. They're going to climb up into tiny little thrones of their own life right off the bat, and they're going to begin to serve themselves. That's why it becomes difficult to be able to even raise kids. They write their own law upon their heart. As Paul Tripp says in the notes here, never once did he ever have his children say to him, "Dad, if you could just give me some more rules, if you could exercise more authority in my life, I would feel so secure and happy with you." If you have kids saying that, kid needs a little help, okay? I mean, I was trying to think of an illustration, and I don't know why this came to mind, and the self-centeredness of kids. But it's a true story of my own childhood, and I was an angel. I was the best one out of the bunch. Take that out of the website, by the way. All right. No, not really. We were on vacation just as Munchkins down in Florida, and back at that time, guys, air conditioning wasn't in every car, okay? And we were in the typical station wagon that did not have air conditioning, and we're driving all over Florida for days. You know, you go all the alligator farms, you go to Cypress Gardens, you go all those places, you know what I'm talking about, back in the 70s. And I get sick when I'm in a car. I get sick driving around in the back seat of a car. And I got sick, and my dad kept saying, "Don't you throw up in the car. Don't you throw up in the car." I think he's looking for a place to pull over somewhere so that I can throw up outside. But no, guy in his selfishness takes his younger sister's brand new purse from Cypress Garden and throws up in it so as not to throw up in the car. She got to keep the parasol, by the way. She got to keep the little umbrella that came with it. But at the next garbage can, it went out. Now, I might have been able to hold it. I don't remember. But I know this, my sister don't have her purse no more, she like, okay? Because I feel much better after having thrown up in it. That's a picture of selfishness, of being able to say that was what was sitting on my heart at that particular time. It's not my sister's own desires to love that little purse that she had just gotten. No, I wanted to feel better, and I wanted to throw up in that so his dad didn't beat me because I threw up in the car. It was about me at that time. But every act of murder, every violent act that we have is motivated by self-love. Every moment of greed is motivated by self-love. Every kind of gossip, every bit of disobedience to parents is rooted in self-love. Every adulterous moment in a person's life is rooted in self-love because we no longer love God. Remember what James says? Where do these quarrels and where do these fights come that are among you? Doesn't it come from the desires and the lust of your own heart? Isn't that where it comes from? It doesn't come because of God's response that you truly love God and this is the reason you need to argue and fight. No, it becomes of a lust and a desire of your own heart that you begin to fight with and fight for. The world is designed to have at its center love for God, but it isn't there any longer, according to Genesis chapter 6. You know how you know God loves these creatures? Exactly the same way whether you know you love a person on this earth. Because when that person will betray you, when that person turns their back upon you, your heart is broken. And that's what happens with God. That's exactly what's happened with God. That is proof that God loves these creatures because his heart is broken. God proves himself not simply as a sovereign, not simply as the creator, not simply as the almighty, not simply as a God of love, but he is heartbroken. He is a God of compassion. He is a God who weeps because human life has betrayed him in its very fundamental form as they no longer have a relationship of love with me. Can you think? Let's kind of let your C.S. Lewis imagination run loose. Can you see the eyes of God filled with tears? That's what it is. That's what he's saying here. Can you hear his ear? Can you listen into the very throne room of heaven? And you hear God weeping because his people no longer love him. They've turned their backs upon him. So what are you going to do? God, what are you going to do about this? There's a response, God. You need to respond to this betrayal somehow. God understood this, that every sin was vertical. Everything that they were doing with and to each other on this face of this earth was simply vertical. It wasn't simply horizontal, but everything had a vertical tendency to it. Everything, that is why David says, against you and you alone have I sinned, God, when he talked about his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah. He didn't say, oh, Lord, if I had only loved Bathsheba more and if I had a love for Uriah more, I wouldn't have done these terrible things. He didn't say that. He said, I didn't have a love for you. David said, I didn't love you. And that is the reason that I didn't. For you and you alone have I sinned against with this of committing adultery with Bathsheba and then having her husband Uriah murdered. That sin, yes, it was against them, but ultimately it was against you, Father, because I didn't love you. It wasn't a matter of me having not enough love for these people horizontally. I didn't have enough love for you, and I did these horrendous things. So, how would you respond to mankind after such a betrayal? Here it is in verse 7 and 8. I'll blot out man whom I've created from the face of the earth. Man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. Wow. And that's a horrible ending to the message this morning. I'm going to blot them out. I don't know how many of you watch TV series 24. I don't know why I like that show. I don't recommend it for people because at the end of each week, it leaves you with another disaster. Each week, you don't kind of breathe and say, boy, that was uplifting. Each week, it was another disaster that occurred upon Jack Bauer. And I don't know why I liked it, because you sit through an hour worth of show and you think I almost wasted an hour in that because it was another disaster. That's pretty much what we see here. God, not in some type of ugly vengeance attitude, but God in a holy, just, righteous attitude, says, enough. Enough. I made you. I owned you. I provided everything that you could possibly want. I gave you life of beauty. I gave you everything. And you turned your back on me. I'll wipe you out. Because that's what you have coming. That isn't a matter of a vengeful God, of an ugly, vengeful, angry God. That is a picture of a just God. That is a picture of a righteous God who cannot look upon that sin that has occurred. And so he is about to send the waters of a worldwide flood to clean the earth of that which he sees and is abhorrent. Seems like that's the end of the story, isn't it? No, guy, you said this is somewhat of a love story. That's all you've talked about for the last 40 minutes. It's love. It's about love. So is there a love ending to this particular story? Thank goodness there is. Look at verse 8. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Wonderful picture here. When you go back, this looks like Noah found favor. Yes, in God's sovereign act, in his grace and grace alone, he placed favor upon this family of Noah. But there's also indications that Noah was a righteous person, that Noah was seeking that which would please God. And I believe that because of that, because of the promises that we see, because of obedience, of a heart leaning toward rightness, God gave favor to Noah. And he says, you build yourself a big boat, and I'm going to protect you from the waters that are coming. And we know the story and how that unfolds. And after the waters recede, God makes a covenant with Noah. And he says to him, very simply, I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to bless your descendants. And then you go on a little bit further, and you read, within those descendants, you come to a name there by the name of Abraham, or Abram, at that time. So Abraham is one of the descendants of Noah. And God reaches down and says to him, another covenant I'm going to give to you, Abraham. And that promise is this. Not only am I going to continue to bless your descendants and the descendants of Noah himself, but through you and through your seed, I am going to bless all nations. I promise that. Not simply your descendants, but I will bless all nations through your descendants. See the picture? Why this little baby in the manger is going to be a reason for celebration? why the little baby in a manger is going to give us reason to give praise and glory to God himself. You see, it's a relational problem. It's not simply behavior. He knows that. Genesis 6 has shown us that this is a matter of the thoughts of people's hearts. It wasn't simply their actions. If life was simply a matter, how many folks are involved in, quote, counseling or discipleship here at the church? To understand that it isn't simply a behavior problem, it's a heart problem. If it was simply a behavior problem, we might be able to modify our behavior enough and be okay. Mike. But it goes deeper than that. It's saying here, it's a heart problem. It's something that you can't do for yourself. Your heart is your heart. It is who you are. And it goes much deeper than simply saying, it's a matter of me just reforming my particular behavior and I can be better. The Bible very clearly all throughout talks about this heart being the causal core, being at the very core and control of everything that we are. The one thing that you cannot do, the one thing that I cannot do, is to escape my heart. Think about it. Can you escape your heart? Can you escape what lies at the very intentions of your heart? Can you escape what satisfies your heart? You can't escape your heart. And that's the problem here. I can't escape my heart. And if my heart is continually evil before God, guess what? I need rescued. I need somebody to step in to do something for me that I cannot do for myself. So guess what God does? Years and years later, he sends little baby Jesus. He sends his son into this world to rescue us from our own selves. Because he steps into a world that is thankless. He steps into a world that is broken. He steps into a world that is absolutely sinful. And he is able to utterly live a perfect life. And what did his motivation, what did Jesus, remember you spent 3 years studying the book of John and looking at the book of John and Jesus' life. What did we see constantly over and over again coming out of the lips of Jesus? What was his motivation? He was sent by the Father because he was here to do the Father's will. He was so in love with God himself that he would do whatever was sent there. He's going to say that in the Garden of Gethsemane. Not my will be done, but yours, Father. If there's any other way, let this pass. But I know that there's no other way. It is your will and your will alone. Something you and I could not do is to live for God. And Jesus came and lived on our behalf. This is the picture of the hope of redemption of a little baby born in Bethlehem. That Messiah is an event, the coming of this Messiah, and Hank so well put it this morning about it, and we'll continue to look at it. It's a picture, it's an event in time, but you understand that the process of the Messiah coming is also, or not the event of the Messiah coming, is also a process. It isn't simply coming at one particular time, but it is a process by which the grace by which he saves us is the grace by which he sustains us. It is the grace by which he gives us constant victory over those sins. And to be able to say, I love God. And most of you in here today love God. But all of you in here today, even those that do love God, will say, but there are certain things that I do that are obvious that I really didn't love God in that instance. Oh, that thought, I love God, but where did that come from? Oh, what I just said and what I just did and my actions. Really, I want them to flow out of the fact that I want to love God. I want to obey him. I want to. So, Lord, what's the answer? You gave me a new heart. He gives you a new heart at one particular moment, yes. But what we also see within this story of the Messiah coming is a continual process of giving us the victory over it. The grace that saves is the grace that sustains. And so when I begin to struggle with that and saying, look, Lord, I love you, but why'd I do that? Forgive me, Father. He sustains us with his grace. The same grace that saves is the same grace that will sustain. The war of love for our hearts constantly goes on. You know that. Guaranteed. If you didn't do it this morning, you did it this week sometime. Where you allowed something other than the love of God to grip your heart. And it is the hope that we have in Jesus Christ to be able to say, these boundaries, Lord, that you have set down, evidence of my love for you, can be kept only by your grace, only by your strength, only by your victory upon the cross. Not simply coming and being born, but dying 33 years later. Only by that victory upon the cross am I able to sustain these boundaries to indicate my love for you. So we see in the moment of this judgment of the flood that was coming wasn't the end of the story that we see in Genesis chapter 6. Because the God of glory, the God of power, the God of sovereignty is also the God of glorious grace. And he'll return to us the capacity to love him in an absolute way that we were designed to love him. We're going to take next week a continual look at this from a different angle, but a continual look at what God has provided in this little baby Jesus. Shall we pray?